MacCast, Saturday, December 10th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I have a great show for you today. I always love it when I get to extend the MacCast community a little bit, and it's fun when I get to introduce you to someone who you haven't heard on the show before, and it's even more fun when it's someone who really knows her stuff when it comes to Apple and the Mac community. So I sat down with Kelly Gaumont of the Unofficial Apple Weblog. Bunch of other things. You're going to hear that in the intro, so I'm not going to repeat all the places where you can find Kelly. She's a busy girl. But it was a lot of fun to sit down, and we chatted about the recent Mac news and some cool little apps and things like that based on Apple's iTunes Rewind list, which just came out. So we give kind of some of our picks for the year of our favorite iOS apps, and it was just a great time. It goes about an hour and a half, so this is a little bit longer show, but you can't stop recording when you're having a good conversation. So I'm glad to share that with you, and I hope you enjoy it too. Before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and recognize a couple of our show sponsors. Let's start it off with Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, this is a great application and tool. If you're an IT professional, you're an educator, you're in business, even in personal, in your home use, you might have a situation where you want to be able to set up a Mac. Maybe you have a computer that's shared among family members or within a business, or you have maybe an internet terminal. You run a small business and you want to make a computer, a Mac available, or could even be a PC because they support Macs and PCs with the Deep Freeze product. But say you want to make a Mac available to multiple users and you want to be able to protect the system, but you still need to have a system or a machine that your users can use and not be encumbered by a bunch of blocks and software that gets in the way. Well, Deep Freeze is a great product for that, because what you can do is you can install the operating system, you can set up the environment in terms of applications, and then you can deploy that system out to your users. And before you do that, you run Deep Freeze and it locks that configuration down. And then you define and set up the areas and places where your users can store persistent data. They call these thaw spaces, and you can do an entire user folder. You can set up specific locations. You can do specific external volumes. And that's kind of the place where people can keep data between sessions, between uses of the system. And while they're using it, they can go ahead and do whatever they want. They can surf the web. They can download stuff. They can install that. But if they put anything outside those defined areas on a reboot, that gets wiped away and restored. So this is great if you have sensitive information. In that example, like setting up a shared computer in an internet cafe, for example, your small business owner, you can have your customers use the system. They can have cookies and browser history saved, even if they, choose to save passwords to the system. A simple reboot, all of that stuff is completely wiped away and restored, and you don't have to worry about their security. They don't have to worry about, leaving extra files or downloaded apps or stuff they might have left on that system. Even if, spyware was downloaded and installed, it's going to get completely wiped off because Deep Freeze is protecting that system and you're restoring that back to its original state on a reboot. It's a really cool product, and you can get more information. You can check it out. They also have free trials available over at Furonix.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. The other thing that might be happening this time of year is you might be getting some new electronics gear. Maybe you're getting a new digital camera. Maybe you're getting a new DVD player, a new Blu-ray player, and you have that old one. What are you going to do with it? Well, you could go through the hassle of listing it on an auction site or an online classified place, but then you have the hassle and the potential risk of dealing with that. Well, Gazelle at gazelle.com offers a great way for you to get cash for your old stuff and not have any of that hassle. And what Gazelle does is they are a re-commerce site. So when you have an old piece of electronics that you no longer need and you want to get rid of, you just go to gazelle.com. You do a simple search through their growing database of electronics, and they will make you an offer. You answer some simple questions about the condition and the types of accessories and stuff that you have, and then they will make you a cash offer, and you can choose to accept that or not. And it's really that simple. And if you take their offer, they will even provide shipping and sometimes can even send you a box to ship it to them in. And then for things that don't have value, if you'd like to just recycle it, you can pay the shipping and they will recycle it for you responsibly. And when they get it into their center, they have a team that processes all that stuff. They wipe off any personal data. So if it's something that has storage on it, they're going to ensure that that's removed. You can certainly remove it before you send it in, and I would encourage you to do that. But even if you forget, they're going to wipe it clean and make sure that it's ready to go out back into the market if they can. And you can get paid by check, PayPal, Walmart prepaid Visa card, or Amazon.com gift card. And you even have the option, if you'd like to donate the value of your item, you can have that given to one of over 100 approved charities that Gazelle works with. So great way to get some cash for your old stuff, especially this time of year when you might be getting new things or just taking an inventory at the end of the year. Go through the garage. Maybe you're doing that final cleaning for the year. Get rid of some of that old stuff and get some cash back. So check it out, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. And now with the business stuff out of the way, well, let's jump right into it. Here was my conversation with Kelly Gaumont. Okay, we got a special treat on this MacCast because I'm not going to be doing the news this week by myself. I got Kelly Gaumont from the unofficial Apple weblog. You're a blogger over there, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I am.
And people can hear you on the International Mac Podcast from time to time. Oh, also the unofficial Apple weblog TalkCast, which happens every week. That's Sunday nights?
Sunday nights, 7 Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern.
And are you still on TalkShoe?
Yes.
Yeah, over on TalkShoe. And that's like live call-in kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, anybody that wants to can call in through the web client or dial in, you know, burn up some of those free weekend cell phone minutes. And we take most people. And we occasionally have special guests, people we've gone out of our way to invite. So we've had Andy Anatko on. We've had various software developers. And at one point, we had Rod Roddenberry of Star Trek fame on the show as well. And I'm working on getting him to come back. And we have a regular bunch of folks that do show up and contribute. And it's a lot of fun. We have a really welcoming community over there.
Cool. And then you just, I did not realize this, but would you call yourself the unofficial over at Angry Mac Bastards, unofficial host?
Unofficially official guest host. When somebody can't make it, then they have me on to fill a seat.
That's another awesome podcast. If people
have they're a lot of fun. You got to brace yourself.
Yeah, it's very different than this show.
It's salty. Yeah, it's definitely one for the headphones, but it's always full of good information, and it's always, and the thing I like about it is there's a lot of poking holes in stupid over there, and the thing about it is you can't do that effectively unless you're really smart, and so I'm thrilled to bits that they had me as a guest at all, and then now they let me come on there on a semi-regular basis, and I find that even more exciting. Because they're really smart and they know what they're talking about, which is always, you know, it's always nice to get to listen to somebody who knows and enjoys what they're holding forth about.
Well, so. I think that makes sense because you're really smart too. I knew about your stuff from your blogging on Tua, and then we met, what was it, last year or the year before?
Last year.
Yeah, last year at Macworld. And then
it
was funny because you've never been on the show, but somehow we were on International Mac Podcast together, and then I tweeted out something, and you're just like, when am I going to be on the show? It's like, right now. Let's get you on. Let's make it happen.
Yeah. Because I decided this year was the year I wanted to go and do everybody's podcast because I went to Macworld this last year. And so many people came up and said, I really enjoy listening to you on the TalkCast over at Tua. And I had no idea that many people were like really into that. So I'm like, well, yeah, that's great. And then a couple of people I met there invited me and said, you should really come on our show. And so I did a couple of different shows. Yeah, this is fun. Yeah. This is something I could get behind. So I've been kind of trying to – I keep calling it conquering everyone else's podcast. So Victor had me on the Typical Mac User podcast to talk about font management, and that was a lot of fun. And I've done Angry Mac Bastards and the International Mac Podcast. And there's a really good, not Mac-centric tech podcast called In30. It's a lot of fun. And those guys, again, wicked smart. And they talk about all different kinds of tech, whatever it is. And it's always 30 minutes on the nose. So they're a lot of fun to chat with.
Cool. Well, we have a large list. We'll see how many of these stories we can get through. And it's funny because This is like, I was talking to you before the show, this is like about just a week of stories. And It's a lot of stuff. So we'll see what we can get through. Yeah. Some of it's holdover from, some of the rumor stuff's holdover, I think, from the past couple of weeks. But I just want to get your take on some of the hardware rumors, because that's what people want to know about. But let's start off with the one at the beginning of the week. I guess it was kind of the end of last week, beginning of this week, the whole Carrier IQ.
Yeah, so
I don't even know what to call it.
Well, I've been calling it kerfuffle, because It's a lot of there's been a lot of knicker twisting over it. Everybody's got panties in a bunch, and the thing that I think people are upset about, to me, it seems like the wrong thing. What people are upset about is there's software on my phone I didn't know about, but there's always been software on your phone you didn't know about. Yeah. The other thing people, I mean, it's just the truth. There's always been some sort of low-level utility that somebody, you know, a technician or something could access to get to hardware failures, basic diagnostics. That's always on there.
Yeah, troubleshooting.
And, you know, maybe you've seen it but not paid any attention to it. You know, that doesn't mean it isn't there. And the thing that a lot of people were worked up about was, but that means they have all my data. Well, if you're sending a text message from your phone to another phone, it's traveled across their network. And You can even have your bill set up where they will print out and show you, we know every call you made and how long it was. We know every text message you sent and where. They already have that information. So the part that people are worked up about, I feel like, is the wrong part. The part that people should be worked up about is, even if you opt out of, you know, if you kill the program, if you try to make it so that that application is not sending data anymore, it's still sending data. And there's been no transparency about that. What it is that they're doing, they said it's not a keylogger. But nobody has said, this is what it's this is the information it's recording from your phone, and this is where it's going. And part of the reason I'm glad this became as big a deal as it eventually did become is because LocationGate was such a huge ding against Apple that went on and on and on. And this is way worse, because that was just location information, and it was being stored on your phone.
Right.
It wasn't really going anywhere. And then even the version that was stored on your phone was anonymized. There was no phone number attached. There was no Apple ID. There was nothing specific that tied that information back to a particular handset or a particular customer. So I'm kind of glad that people are worked up about it, because it is kind of a security thing and sort of a consumer awareness thing, you know, that people really need to understand. But to be as worked up about it as people were, I thought was a little overdone.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that interested me about this too, though, was I do think it's a valid point to say it seemed like they were gathering a lot of information. Yes, we needed to have the diagnostic information and things like that, but there was a lot in there that maybe wasn't necessarily required to accomplish that task. And I think that is a valid complaint.
Stuff. Yeah. And there was a lot. They were recording a lot more. And no one has said, you know, all we could really find out about it was what could be reverse engineered. And I think it was a jailbreaker who found the actual stuff in the first place. And the thing about it that that we still don't know, because all we know is what he was able to determine, which is this application continues to collect data even if you kill it. And we don't know what that data is or where that data is going. So if it was just uptime, or it's running some sort of rudimentary hardware scan and beaming that scan off every couple of minutes, you know, for me personally, I don't care. I would like to have that information somewhere if my phone were to completely go haywire, so that, you know, maybe it's something that's retrievable and they can go, oh, well, it looks like, you know, your signal has been failing for some time. There may be an issue with your hardware and we can get you swapped out. You know, I'm okay with that. And Apple has allowed people to opt into diagnostic information. I don't know if it was Carrier IQ or not when you did this. But when you first set up your phone and you walk through the iTunes setup, it will say, do you want to send diagnostic information back to Apple? And I always say yes.
Right.
Because I feel like I'm helping in some way. You know, like right now I'm running iOS 5 and until I went to 5.01, I wasn't really having the battery issue. And now I'm having the battery issue on my 4. Not my 4S, but my 4. And so I'm hoping that that diagnostic information is going back to Apple because I want it to get fixed.
Right. Right.
So, you know, who I call and where I go and that kind of stuff. Like I know they're going to have a certain amount of that information by virtue of the fact that I'm using someone else's network to make those calls.
Yeah. I mean, by nature of being online.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the one thing that I had bookmarked, and I think it was a piece over at Macworld, they pointed to some research done by Dan Rosenberg, who I think was the guy who kind of came out most in trying to explain or counteract some of the things. The guy's name was Kyle, I think was the name of the guy who kind of discovered and exposed this. And then Dan is a supposedly security researcher, and he came back and kind of tried to clarify exactly the types of information that was being collected.
Right.
You know, he literally said on his thing, they cannot record SMS text messages or web page contents or email contents. And I thought that was particularly interesting because, like I think you were saying in the pre-show, you know, a lot at the end of this year, people are looking for stories, you know, looking for things to drive traffic and stuff like that. And I think a lot of us get caught up in that, right?
Particularly when you're being led to believe that something is a huge deal. And I'm not saying Carrier IQ is not a big deal, but all of the wringing of hands and the wailing and gnashing of teeth that's been going on about it, I think a lot of that has been really overdone. There's been a lot of sort of breathless, oh my God, coverage, and I just don't think it's really necessarily warranting that. I think this is definitely an issue, but it would be better served by a little bit more even-handedness. And yes, we know it's an issue. You don't have to get excited about it. Here's what you need to know. Here's what you can do to make it better, to, you know, protect yourself, to be aware of what your phone is doing.
Yeah, and see, that's what it comes down to. Well, a couple things here. So on this show, and we talked about this ahead of time too, you do this at the Unofficial Apple Weblog. I do this on my podcast. I don't rush, you know, I'm not one of these podcasts that rushes to get stories out.
Sure.
What I try and do is I cull information from a bunch of sources and try and dig a little bit deeper. You know, when something like this breaks, it's always sensationalized. And that's become our society. And it's not even just tech. It's our society now globally is headlines, Twitter, you know, it's like quick, everything in under 140 characters, and we make assumptions and jump to conclusions. A lot of us do. Not everybody.
No, people who are more concerned about being first than being correct are the ones that are coming out and doing these kinds of things. And nobody gives as much attention when a site that does this sort of reporting walks back those stories.
Right.
And so it's really not as big a deal as we kind of told you it was. That never gets as much attention as this is a big deal.
Right.
So,
and so I always encourage, you know, people on this show, and that's what I try to deliver. And I think you do over at Unofficial Apple Weblog too, is okay, that's important. Something's going on here.
Yes.
So there's no doubt something's going on here, but what I try and encourage my audience to do and try and help them do is step back and say, okay, let's get all sides of this and try and dig and figure out, okay, what do we really need to be concerned about? What should we just be aware of? And I think at the end of all of this, what it comes down to is same things that come up when we hear about, you know, viruses on the Mac or viruses on your, you know, malware or spyware on your iPhone. Mm-hmm. You have to step back and look at, okay, what is it? Oh, it's a proof of concept, but yes, this is something we need to be concerned about. I probably should educate myself about. I should be knowing what kinds of information I'm putting out there, and I should be thinking before I sign up for a Gmail account. You know, they mentioned email in this Carrier IQ thing. Oh, they can read your emails. Well, how many of these same people that are getting concerned have Gmail accounts?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Gmail has all your email, folks.
Right.
You know, it's on their servers. And the other thing
is, they scan it for keywords, which is where the ads on the right come from.
Right.
I mean, this is the, like, a, you know, a few people were kind of worked up about that when Gmail was still an invite only situation, and people kind of got over it. They were like, it's okay with me if they're doing that. And yeah, anybody who's using any webmail service, I don't care if it's logging into the web page for your mail from your ISP, whether it's Yahoo, whether it's Gmail, MSN, Hotmail, I can't even think of who all still does webmail service anymore. Right. Any of those people, they have your mail. And they know what it says.
Well, it's even more than that. I have to remind people, you know, this isn't even a Gmail thing. This has been since email has existed. Unless you're encrypting it, you know, unless you're using tools to encrypt it and decrypt it, it's also getting copied on every server that it bounces through on its way to you or to its recipient. So this is why, you know, when the government needs to subpoena for emails, they can find emails that you thought you deleted 5 years ago. Because there's a copy on some server somewhere.
Right.
And but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be aware of these things and concerned about them.
And it doesn't mean stop sending email.
No, but it might mean, you know what, this is one email I really don't want anybody to read. Maybe I should take the responsibility and protect myself and figure out a tool, whatever that might be. And it comes back on this carrier IQ thing. You know, think about what it means when you say, yes, this app can use my location, or
yes to whatever you're saying.
Well, yeah. And on the, I mean, the Android side, Google, to their credit on Android, they've made that very transparent in terms of, you know, if you've ever used an Android app on a phone, it pops up and it kind of tells you everything that that is requesting in terms of permissions. And they had to do that because their system's open. You know, on the iPhone side, it pretty much just can't do a lot of that stuff, which is where a lot of the complaints come against it.
Right.
But I've used an Android phone, and it's scary.
For people who haven't spent a lot of time with an Android device, it's very similar if you've used Chrome. It's very similar to when you install an extension in Chrome, because when you install the extension, it says, here's what this extension wants access to. Is that okay?
Right. And so many
you have to explicitly approve that extension. Yes, it's okay with me if this has access to my browser history or to my bookmarks or whatever it is. And the other nice thing about that is that you have that sort of secondary check. You know, you can look at that and go, well, yeah, it's a bookmark manager, so I assume I'm going to need to give it access to my bookmarks. If all it is a theme, you know, I don't need to give a theme access to my browser history. I don't think I want to install this. I'm not sure what it's doing.
Right.
So I like that it gives you that that piece of information, and it kind of gives you another little sort of check. So you can look at it and go, yeah, maybe that's not the best idea.
Yeah. And bringing it back to what you're saying earlier, I mean, I do think the bigger thing on this carrier IQ thing is just a lot of people were unaware that this was there, that they were opted into it, that it was doing this sort of thing. And well, I think companies need to be more transparent about that. Huh?
Sprint denied it existed at first. The first thing Sprint said was, what? Carrier who? What? No. We don't know anything about it. that was their first.
Right. And I think it did come out, you know, Carrier IQ said, look, we write and build the software, but these vendors tell us, you know, what's enabled and what pieces they want to collect for this diagnostic purpose, right? I think that was that kind of their scapegoat or their out was like,
there was a T-Mobile memo that came out that said there were a stack of handsets that had Carrier IQ installed, and it said, here's what that was recording. Mm-hmm. So, and then I think there was somebody had a photo of an internal memo at Sprint that said a similar thing. So, you know, Sprint was totally proven wrong. It was very interesting to see that. And what I really want to come out of this is a little bit more customer awareness. I like anything that makes people aware. Mm-hmm. Not paranoid, but aware. There's a line.
Yes.
and I really want for people in the United States in particular to have a greater understanding and awareness of the relationship your carrier has with you, and seeing where the lines between what the hardware makers and what the mobile providers is, where are those relationships, what is whose responsibility. And some people had that because as smartphones got more common, you would go into the store. You know, it used to be if you had a feature phone, you know, you'd go into the store and you'd go, my Razer doesn't work. And they'd go, oh, well, let me help you sort that out. Because there were only a few things it could really be. You know, and then they'd just give up and give you a new phone if they needed to. And as phones got more complex, it was, you need to call Samsung about this. You need to call Apple. You need to go to the Apple store because this is a problem with your phone, not a problem with your service. And I think people are starting to get more aware of that as iPhones and Android devices become more common. But I really want people to understand what it is the carriers are out for in this case. And, you know, carriers don't necessarily think of people as customers. They think of them as cash flow.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's about the most diplomatic thing I can say about cellular carriers in the United States, I think. And part of the issue was a very good point that you made in the pre-show, which is when I was saying, you know, I want people to have awareness here like they have in the rest of the world and, you know, consumer protection and that sort of thing, like they've got in Europe and in Asia. And you said, well, in those places, you know, they don't have the lobby.
Right.
Which is very, very true. And I would, you know, I really want to see something, you know, something change on that front. I've wanted to see that for years. I got my first mobile phone number in 1998. So I've been at this a long time. I've used so many handsets. I've broken them. I've literally used them to death. I went through like 4 Motorola Razors, the old one.
yeah.
Because they just didn't work. And, you know, like the frustration I had with my smartphone, with what's Apple's problem and what's AT&T's problem. You know, for me, it's a very easy thing. Like if my mom had an iPhone or my dad had an iPhone, I'm not sure they would understand the line quite so clearly. And I really want for people to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, and I think the benefit for us as Apple users is, frankly, Apple owns that. And I think that's one of the complaints that some people on the Android side have, is that there is sometimes some finger pointing going back and forth. But if you have an AT&T problem or a Verizon problem or now a Sprint problem related to your phone, and you take it into an Apple store, they're well enough trained to recognize, and at least they will help you and sort of assist you and try and do what they can for you. I have not heard that similar experience from some people with Android phones where they go in and they say, well, the problem's with the operating system with Google, you should contact Google. And then you go, okay, well, how do I contact Google?
Yeah.
Oh, you can't.
Yeah, that is the $64,000 question on Android. How do you get a hold of Google to fix that? One thing I do like, I've seen, I've been in Apple stores and seen the mobile appointments happening, and I do like that they are at least well enough trained that they can give you the phrase that pays. So they can tell you, call AT&T, tell them this.
Right.
And they will either that or the other thing. And, you know, and here's how it'll go. And I really like that they've got that relationship. So they can make that connection. And then that way, you know what to expect a little bit when you call them, because they can say, this is the deal. This is what, you know, you get a little bit of help when you have to talk to them so that they don't try and, you know, shuffle you off to the Apple store or, you know, someone else.
Yeah.
You know, so, to get your problem fixed. So it's nice that they do that.
So since we're kind of talking about the carriers, I'm going to use this as my transition. I want to talk a little bit about, because it came up for one of my listeners, this data throttling story. I saw it a couple of places this week with AT&T, and it's funny that it's coming up now because this was a policy AT&T actually switched over to in August, I think, where they said, look, if you're grandfathered in on the unlimited data plans, and a lot of us are, I've kept my unlimited data plan and I'm not even using it, but
I cling to mine.
Yeah, but I don't know why. So that's one part of this I want to talk about a little bit. But the story this week was that, and I found out about it because one of my listeners emailed me and said, look, I got the email. I guess AT&T's maybe sending out more emails suddenly about people going over this 5% threshold. And he was shocked because he said, you know, I used 2.3 gigabytes of data. So AT&T's new plan, the data plus plan, the one that's supposed to be for, you know, people who use more data, is a 2 gigabyte cap. And so he goes, how could that be that I'm in the top 5% of data users when I'm just barely over sort of that that threshold? And that turns out to be a reality. I've done a little bit of research on this and asked a number of people. about it. And really, according to AT&T's numbers, and I think this isn't just marketing fluff on AT&T's side, there's a lot of people that don't use very much data is what it comes down to.
There really are. I mean, and people, I don't know how aware people are of the amount of data that they're using. If you check an email once in a while, if you tweet from time to time, and you send a text message here and there, make some phone calls, you know, which isn't even data.
Right.
You know, unless you're living in voicemail, which is data.
Right.
Unless you're living in voicemail and email on your phone, then yeah, you're not going to come up against that cap.
Yeah, and so I was shocked too until I stepped back and kind of thought about it that, you know, because I looked at my data usage and I've been watching it to try and figure out why am I clinging on to this unlimited plan, because I just have this fear that at some point I'm going to, because my data usage gets heavier as I get more apps, as I get more stuff, and I'm like, at some point I know I'm going to go over the 2 gigs. And even now a year into it, I have 1 month a year when I'm not at home. I go on a camping trip for about a week, and that's my only connection. And even then, I go just over that two kind of gig cap.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem is that it seems to be that they're singling out all these people who have clung on to their unlimited plans.
Yeah.
And it seems like a big push to get us off of it. So
I think it is.
They're kind of sending these letters, hey, you're over the 5%. And then what happens when you go over, which is what I'm more frustrated about, because I do have this 1 month where I know I'll go over. So I know I'm going to go over in June. I'm going to get this letter, and they data throttle you. So they take you from your 3G speed and throttle you down to basically what amounts to a dial-up speed, and you're stuck there for a month.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is insulting to me, because I pay, you know, $10 or $5 more a month, I guess, than I would on that other plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been for years now.
But you're paying for it, and so you should be getting what you're paying for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not paying for a dial-up data plan. I'm paying for 3G.
Yeah. So in that, I don't know I necessarily agree with. But then the flip side of it is this. You know, you don't want to admit that AT&T's marketing hype is probably right. But because I only go over that 1 month a year, I actually would be much better off both financially and probably from a data perspective, if I just went to the Data Plus plan and then paid the $10 for the extra gig on that month that I went over. And those customers aren't throttled, although there was some people saying this week that they were getting throttled when they went over their 2 gig on the Data Plus plan. But AT&T officially came out and said, look, we do not do that. And I think that has been confirmed.
Yeah, I think I know there were some people that had reported that they were getting throttled, and I just don't know if they stopped throttling them or what exactly it was that happened. Cause I have a hard time believing that 2.3 gig in a month puts you in the top 5%.
Yeah. And I spent some time with AT&T and talked to them, and you know, they said, depending on your market, it can. So if you're in a really heavily congested market, they were arguing that, you know, that's a different scenario than if you're in someplace where it's not that congested, right? So if you're in San Francisco and you go to 2 point, or New York or someplace like that, and you go to 2.3, you're probably not going to end up in that top 5% of data users. But if you're in some small town in middle America,
what is their top 5%?
Yeah. And so that was the other part of this story that got me irritated. And I said this to the representative I was talking to. I said, you know, that doesn't make any sense, that you're going to have different rules and different definitions for that 5% depending upon location. So they're basing it off of market, which in some ways you think, oh, well, that kind of makes, from a mathematical standpoint, that makes sense, right? You know, you're calculating
based on an average
for the area.
But it means I'm getting throttled. If I'm the top 5% in Pendleton, Oregon.
Exactly.
Which is a small town in Eastern Oregon. If I'm in the top 5% there, I could be in the top 5% data usage in Portland at 200 meg.
Right.
So you're going to throttle me for a month for 200 meg?
And you know? So to me, that's a funny thing. When I found out about this, that's something nobody's talking about. And I think that's almost the bigger story.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
if you're using 3 gig of your unlimited plan in New York, no problem. If you're using 3 gig of your unlimited plan in Portland, maybe here they're going to throttle you.
Right.
And yeah, I would have to call shenanigans on that.
So that's what I was told. Again, that was from a support supervisor. So I have to go back to PR, you know, really to confirm that. But it wouldn't surprise me if that was sort of how they were doing it. If they're just looking at, you know, the aggregate for an area and, oh, you're in the top 5%. They automate these systems, right? They're not going to spend the time to, like, really do this right. They're just writing an algorithm and things go out and things happen. So, at the very least, if they're going to be doing this for those of us on unlimited plans, they need to define it and say, this is what it is, so that you know when you're getting close and you can either change your behavior or change your plan.
Right.
So, yeah, that's the bigger story in my opinion.
Absolutely.
So, you want to talk a little bit about WebOS? That just happened today, I think.
Yes.
It looked like it was gone and going away, along with HP's hardware. And then,
with HP,
you know, Meg doesn't get into Congress, and so she's over there at HP, and she says, no, WebOS is going open source, and hey, there may be some new hardware in the future.
Now, even almost more importantly than the new hardware coming is that the existing hardware will get updates.
Huh. So all those people that picked up those low-cost tablets on their way out are going to...
The touchpads, yeah. I've heard tell there's another... Word on the tweet is there's another wave of those $99 beauties coming out. So the thing that always sort of made me chuckle about those is that everybody was buying them and they were going, see, it's a success. And no. A $99 tablet for $99 that doesn't do anything isn't going to make people excited. A $400 or $500 tablet for $99, that's another story. People aren't buying it for functionality. People are buying it because it's a screaming deal on some hardware. And if it breaks, $99. What are you going to do? So I'm really excited that they're open sourcing it.
Yeah. Did you pick up a WebOS tablet on Fire Sale?
I did not.
Now I'm kind of regretting it.
That's why I was kind of excited to hear that more were coming, because I kind of want one. Because WebOS, I think WebOS is great. It was a nice evolution of Palm OS, which I was a huge fan of for many, many years. I had a Palm VX. I had a Tungsten T3. And I used them constantly. Even when I first got my first iPhone, which was an iPhone 3G.
Oh, see, I had a handspring.
I still carried my palm around. Yeah, I had a handspring for a while.
Pfizer.
Yeah.
They got bought up and turned into the palms, if I'm remembering my chronology right.
They got bought and they spun off and then they kind of spun back in.
Yeah.
I think was how it went. And
it's when they started making the hybrid phony type.
Yeah, the Trios.
Yeah, Trio, that was it.
The Trios were great, and you know, WebOS I thought was very cool, and I really thought it had a lot of potential, and the thing that I liked the best about it was it was another really easy thing you could develop for, and it was another alternative. So for the people who weren't really interested in becoming part of the Android holy war, they didn't have to. And people who, at the time... iPhones were still starting at like $300 when the first wave of Palm WebOS phones was released. It was nice because you had a reasonably priced alternative. It didn't do everything that an iPhone would do or everything an Android phone would do, but it did a lot for a lot of people. And it was a solid OS. It was really easy to write stuff for. And I really liked it because it was a viable alternative. And I'm always excited about a viable alternative because I always look forward to the day. I still don't think we're there, but I always look forward to the day when Apple is forced to compete. Somebody else is making something awesome. And people may want that instead of what we have. So maybe we need to build something even better. Because right now, the way things kind of work at Apple, like in my mind, when they develop features or they're looking at, you know, what's going to go into 10.8, what's going to go into the iPad 3, the next iPhone, when they are looking at that, they're sort of going, you know what would be great? You know what we should do? You know what would be a fun thing to develop? You know, they do a lot of that. You know, there's some listening to the community, but then there's a lot of, wouldn't it be great if we could make it do this? You know, wouldn't it be great if you could talk to your phone and it did stuff for you? You know, they're not forced to compete. It's not, you know what's awesome in Android is this thing, and we really need to have something like that so we can compete. Right. And I'm always excited about something that makes Apple think that they have to compete, because look how good they're doing now without that.
Right. Yeah, it's one of those weird things in my mind, because I always think that in most cases, Apple doesn't even care about competing. They kind of do their own thing, and they decide what they think is going to be cool. But then every once in a while, something creeps in, like the new, quote-unquote, new notification system in iOS 5.
Yeah.
And you go, I think that was borrowed, you know? And they've borrowed some stuff from Windows on, you know, Mac OS 10. And stuff flows the other way every once in a while, you know?
Yeah. But I like that idea, and I like it pleases me. Just like I wanted Android to be light and fast and solid and awesome. And I wanted Windows 7 to be solid and awesome. And I want Windows 8 to be super fantastic, because I'm always looking for the thing that's going to make Apple go, now we have to compete. We really have to dig in and build something that's super fantastic instead of just plain old fantastic.
Yeah, well, it keeps us honest. It keeps us in check, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like we really have to do, you know, we really have to do something, because, yeah, you know, Metro is kind of sexy and it's really fast and look at all the stuff it can do out of the box, you know. Those are the kinds of things that I'm always excited about. So I get a lot of heat for that on the TalkCast when I say things like, I want Windows 8 to be super awesome and I want Android to just really be cool. And, you know, and it kills me that WebOS is gone, because at that point, you know, when they killed the touchpads, they weren't really clear about what was going to happen to the OS. They just said it wasn't dead.
Right.
So I'm really excited that it's open source. I like when things are open, and I like when things are available to everybody. Like right now, anybody can go be an iOS developer and build whatever the heck they want, and, you know, and they can distribute through the App Store if they are willing to abide by certain rules. Or you can make a really awesome little web thing and just pass that around, you know, that makes your phone do something cool. I have one of those that we'll talk about later. But I really like giving that idea over to everybody, because everybody will inevitably come up with an idea that you will wish you'd had.
Now, I was just looking. Did they give a time frame on when they're going to open source? I mean, is it like open source now, or when are they?
I did not see an official timeline. That doesn't mean they're isn't one, but I don't remember actually seeing, yes, this is when it's going to be.
And then just to let people know, I did on the hardware side, they're saying, you know, there's going to be new hardware. They're not giving any time frame for that. It might not even be 2012.
Or
it might be 2013.
Factor.
Yeah, they're just saying, we need some time to get this thing right, which I think is great. I think that was a perfect statement to say. It's just like, we're not just going to try and build another iPad clone.
Right,
you know,
but I liked the idea that, you know, don't lose faith, it's coming.
Yeah.
We are, you know, I really liked that they did, in fact, commit to something new, whatever that is.
Yeah.
You know, we are going to build more hardware for it, and it is going to be open. And I think that, for me, that's really exciting, because it also is another one of those, the barrier of entry is very, very low. Because if it's open, you can just haul off and whatever, you know? And what I like about that is it gives a lot of people an opportunity to become a developer or learn to do something new that they didn't know how to do before.
Yeah.
With a very, very low barrier of entry. Like, you can just go put up a web page and then hit it from your device and, you know, see how you do.
Yeah. I'm in an iOS development group here in San Diego, and the guy who started it is a huge web iOS, you know, proponent. He really believes in the whole, you know, doing a website, the original vision that Steve had for apps on the iPhone. And it is amazing. If you dive in, there's some amazing things you can do. And I think we've seen it with some of the web-based, you know, apps that we've seen come out since then. It's funny that some of the developers now who have not been happy with the terms on Apple's app, you know, Apple's store are now doing web apps. You know, they're going, hey, maybe this web app thing, maybe there's something to this. And maybe we can build some really robust things. I mean, the Kindle app that came out is amazing, and somebody has a streaming audio app too, I think.
And with HTML5, as long as browsers, this is the other thing that really makes me excited about it, as long as browsers are standards compliant, as long as what you're building functions within those standards, then you're good.
Yep.
And I think that's awesome, and that's one of the things I really like about it. So that's a bonus to what to what I think Palm did here was, or HP, I guess now, was they came out and said, here's what we're doing. We're committed to this platform. It's open source. Anybody that wants to build for it can build for it. And I thought that it was, I thought it was a really nice thing. I really wanted it to go open source. I wanted it not to be something that was a good idea that got killed.
Yeah, it's great that it's going to live on. Well, let's bring it back to Apple's hardware. I want to rapid fire through kind of the three latest rumors. You know, now that we've gotten past the iPhone, I guess we still have the iPhone 5 ones kind of floating out there, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about next thing, everything Betty's expecting, or the next three things, I guess, a lot of people are expecting from a rumor side. Let's start with the iPad 3, because I think that probably will be the first thing that we'll see.
Odds are good.
What do you think? I don't know that there's anything spectacular here. I just need to bring it up because I don't think we've talked about it on the MacCast yet. Retina display is the big piece of this, right?
That's the only big evolution, or I guess revolutionary bonus I could see in the new iPad, is if it were Retina display.
Yeah, and
the other things are going to be, the other things are going to be bumps. It's dual core now, so it will just continue to be dual core.
You don't think they'll go quad yet?
I don't know. I think battery is where that becomes an issue.
Well, and especially because this new Retina display, there's rumors that it will require an extra LED backlight to kind of make it more even across the panel, which will add a little, a minuscule amount of thickness, they're saying. Still 9.7 inch. And as far as resolution, it's doubling the current resolution. And I, of course, didn't write it down.
But that probably makes it a higher resolution than my 13-inch MacBook.
it's gonna look nice if they can do it. You know, yield problems, and we've heard some of these rumors that, you know, there might be shortages. It's hard for these factories to start cranking out these higher pixel density displays in volume, and I think they've been working on it for a long time. It may be why we didn't see a Retina display. You know, just my theory, my thinking, why we didn't see one on the iPad 2.
Yeah, I'm sure that's why. Because they had a hard enough time with it at iPhone 4 size.
Yeah. Now, the big thing this week that I saw is there's a couple sources citing maybe a February launch. And to me, that seems not likely.
No.
Okay.
Not.
We're on the same page there.
Just hot on... I would consider that too hot on the heels of the 4S.
Yeah.
And, you know... Now, an event in February, I could see that.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's happened before. I just don't see any reason to bump up the sort of launch schedule.
No.
You know, there's no compelling reason, especially with the iPad 2 out there still selling really well. And this is, people on my show probably get tired of me hearing me say this, but, you know, I always come back to the money. I think a lot of times we as Apple fans forget that, you know, all this stuff is driven by the revenue stream.
Yeah.
And if you're selling iPad 2s, the longer you can sell them, the component costs go down, your production, you know, and the more you sell, the more profit you're making. So,
well, another tidbit we heard this week on that same front is that the 3GS is still pretty popular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, with a lot of people. Yeah. Like, enough that they're still manufacturing those at a reasonably healthy clip.
Well, they were saying the prediction isn't that when the December numbers come out that they will have sold 2 million units of the 3GS and probably 1 million of the CDMA iPhone 4?
Yeah.
Was it? So
that's not a number to sneeze at. Who else sold 2 million two-year-old phones in this quarter?
Well, and I think a lot of that's because of, I've known a couple people who've gotten the 3GS because it's the almost free, practically free phone. Wasn't it free for a while and then it went up to a buck? Was that what AT&T
did
that?
Yeah, it's like $1 now. Yeah.
We talked about that. We're like, what is the rationale in that? Like,
dollar.
Now it's a dollar instead of free?
Yeah, I don't understand. But like, if I was going to get my mom or my dad a full-on smartphone, that's what I would probably get them. Not a 4. They're not going to do enough with it that they're going to care that much, honestly. The 4 would be a nicer looking screen, but like the 3GS for like all the parents in my life, because my parents are divorced and remarried, so I have bonus parents, and my in-laws, I would be happy to give any of them a 3GS because it's a solid little phone.
You don't need the FaceTime. You don't need them FaceTiming you.
Yeah, I don't need to hand my dad the nostril cam. I really don't.
Yeah.
Which is what I that's all the front one is really, because no one remembers to hold it up. So it's just the nostril cam.
Yeah. Somewhat related to the 2 million, 3GS units is Maynard Oom predicted Apple's gonna sell 30 million total iPhones in the fourth quarter, which to me is that's a huge number.
That's you hear numbers and you just think that's a crazy number. And I think that's a crazy number. I know that they did ridiculously well with the 4S. I know.
Yeah.
30 million ridiculous? I don't think so.
Well, and I think that's all phones, right? That counts these 3GSs and 4s and 4Ss. Yeah. And yeah. So plausible. It seems a little high to me too, but
28 million. See. Well, if you think if the 3GS did do 2 million, then that's 28 million 4s and 4Ss. And that just seems so high to me.
Everybody seems to have an iPhone. That's the phone that see everywhere. I don't, you see Androids, you see other ones. It's funny too, because I think overall Android's selling, or they're selling more units now than
yeah. Well, and iPhones. it's also hardware versus software. Right. There are more units out there that run Android. So there will tend to always be more flavors of Android available, but right. For hardware, Apple's it.
Well, that's just the thing. But even just non-iPhones, like everybody I see out and about seems to have an iPhone. So I don't know if like people with Android phones just don't use them as much, or like why I don't see them.
Yeah, they don't get them out. They don't like them as well. So they don't have them out all the time.
Maybe we're just vain. I don't know. That's been levied against Mac users or Apple users in the past too. But why wouldn't we be?
Forever.
We've got beautiful devices.
I know. Why wouldn't I take it out of my pocket and
speaking
around?
Of that, MacBook Air... So the other rumor that's been kind of surfacing recently is a 15-inch MacBook Air sometime early in 2012.
I'm conflicted about this because what I always wanted them to do, and I know this sounds weird, but go with me on it. I want them to go back in time because years ago, back in 19, I bought a PowerBook 1400. This was called the Lego PowerBook. Because it all kind of pulled apart in different pieces. You could slide off the speaker grill and then lift up the keyboard, and there were all your computer innards. It was awesome.
Huh.
It also had this like customizable cover. But one of the things that
I remember that one.
Yeah. One of the things that I always enjoyed about the PowerBook in particular, back when they were all still this dark gray plastic, was the expansion bay situation. So there was this little bay on the side and you could put in a floppy drive because this was still back in the days of the floppy. Remember floppies, kids?
Right.
And you could pop that out and you could swap it for the optical drive. I rarely used the optical drive and it took more battery to have that one in there. So I used the floppy drive most of the time. You could also buy a battery to put in there instead and have an extra battery.
Right.
And cool. I want them to go back in time to that. And I want them... I feel like at 15-inch, it's not an Air anymore. So what I really want for them to do is give you an option of you have this bay where the optical drive is now. You can change out the optical drive for an SSD or an extra battery. Or if you really want the drive in there, we'll put the drive in there for you.
Yeah, I think those days might be long gone. I think Apple's moving in the direction. The one thing about this 15-inch Air rumor is, and I totally agree with you on the size thing. My thing is I think everybody they're calling it an Air in the rumors because it's that form factor, it's that slim SSD, it's got all of the attributes of an Air. But I think it's just we knew when the Airs came out, this is the way the Pros are going.
Yeah, it's going to be the new MacBook Pro.
It's the first generation of the new MacBook Pro, and they're starting with the 15-inch. The 17 is just a beast, and I don't know if they'll ever be able to do anything with that.
It's beautiful, but I look at that, and I go, do you know how unhappy I am when I have to huff my 13-inch unibody MacBook across the airport? I would die.
Well, unfortunately for you, I think your dream of going back to the old days, if they did on any one of the notebook models, it would be the 17-inch Pro. That would make a lot of sense for the 17-inch Pro because that's the workhorse, machine that professionals really, who are video editors and need to do a lot with their systems. I mean, it's still the one that has the Express card slot in it, right?
Right.
Yeah, and because they need like that expansion.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that, but I like that idea, and I like, you know, maybe you can have an optical drive. If you don't want an optical drive, maybe you'd like an SSD in there, and you could have two, you know, or a rotational and a solid state. Because somebody sells that kit, and I'm eyeing it.
You might also argue you have that with Thunderbolt, though.
Yeah, but I don't have Thunderbolt because I have a unibody MacBook.
But the new ones. So, you know, rather than having that expansion slot where you could drop a thing in, you're going to have a little box that hangs off your Thunderbolt port and you can put, you know, PCI cards in there. You can put SSD drives in there. You can put, you know, whatever you want in there. Yeah. And there's your expansion for your ultra thin 15-inch MacBook Pro.
But really, this makes a lot of sense, I think, if you consider it, if for no other reason than the Mac App Store is doing everything they can to eliminate physical media.
Yep.
So if you don't have to have a CD to install things from anymore, then why do you need the drive?
Yeah. You know? Backup. I mean, a lot of people still argue they need it for backup, but
yeah,
they don't store enough. I mean, even to me, a Blu-ray, which Apple has never supported, so that's just a pipe dream anyway.
Yeah.
still not enough.
I mean, honestly, I can almost guarantee that the last five things that I put into my optical drive were blank CDs because I burned a stack of MP3s to put in my car because my car player will play MP3 discs. And it's nice to have a disc in there if I don't want to take my phone out and plug it in.
You have that right next to the 8-track?
No. I don't have an 8-track anymore.
That'd be cool, though.
I did have an 8-track in my car. My first car had an 8-track player in it.
That's awesome. All right, and then the last hardware rumor, and the one that seems to be getting a lot of buzz from the bigger media, I think, is Apple TV. Apple's
going to
make a television set.
Yes.
Which they have made before. I'll just point out to everybody.
Only sort of.
No, well, there was the Mac TV.
Oh, the Mac TV. Okay, I thought you were talking about
it. It might have even been called the Apple TV. You know, it was a black. It was like, looked like one of the performers, but it was black, and it actually had a TV tuner in it.
I think it was Mac TV.
It was Macintosh TV, I think is what it was called, yeah.
Yeah.
So they did do one, but nah, we don't count that.
But it was, what it was a computer that could do TV stuff. It
exactly.
wasn't a TV.
It was
a
not
computer.
A TV TV. You're right. Yeah.
Which is different. And yeah, it was Macintosh TV.
So, but then this rumor gets crazy. So this has been around for a long time. Victor Cahiao has been maintaining Apple's going to build a TV at some point. The only place that I ever saw it, maybe I could see them doing something like a 30-inch, 32-inch, you know, Thunderbolt display that also is a TV. But I'm even shying away from that now. You know, now people are saying, well, TV, yeah, maybe. But then the rumors start getting weird. They start going, oh, well, it's going to be double the resolution, and it's going to be twice as expensive as a current TV. And you're going, really? Who's going to buy this thing? Like, even as a fan, I don't know if
I don't want that. I'm an AV nerd, and I look at that and go, really?
You know, I mean, waiting for prices to come down so I can actually buy one. I mean, I still have a tube TV.
Wow. So you're the one. AV is serious business at my house. And I look at some of those rumors, and I just go, not even at my house is this going to fly.
And not even if it has Siri? You know, you can voice control it. That's going to be the big thing, right? That's how Apple cracks TV. Because that's what's broken about my TV is that I can't talk to it.
The thing, well, I talk to my TV all the time. It just doesn't do anything when I do. The thing that I want from this is the thing that I wanted initially when I took the first look at iTV, which is what they initially called the Apple TV, the first one that was silver and looked like a mini.
Mm-hmm.
When they first debuted that, it was Macworld 2007. And it was the same year we got the iPhone Steve Note. And there was this little ITV thing over on the side. And wait, it was either 2007 or 2008.
Yeah.
Because I was there both years. And I don't remember.
I had to bring up Mac Tracker all the time.
Yeah,
I'll do that while you're talking. I'll look up the date.
So when I first saw that, it might be 08. And the thing that struck me about it was, finally, Apple's making hardware to hook to my television with the express purpose of hooking to my television. The thing that I wanted out of it was I wanted them to buy TiVo. Because TiVo, their hardware leaves a bit to be desired, but their software is beautiful. TiVo lets you search for the name of your TV show and go, yeah, record every single one that's ever on ever. Or only record the ones on this channel. Like, particularly if you like a show that's also syndicated, this is very handy. Because you can go, yeah, only record the episodes of CSI that show up on CBS, because those are new episodes. Don't record the ones on any other channel, because those are all syndicated reruns. I don't care about that. Right. I already saw them. And so for me, that's the thing about TiVo that I thought was great. And I always wanted Apple to have, and I know they won't because they're Apple, but I always wanted them to have some sort of alliance with somebody like TiVo, because TiVo service is great. And then if I could get beautiful Apple hardware that did everything that my TiVo would do, that hooked up to my, that I could hook my cable up to and go, here's the deal, here's the thing, here's the stuff, done, I would be pleased to bits.
Yep.
And I wanted that to happen so badly, and it won't. So I'm going to say it again, because I still – I want this to be what happens, and I don't think it will be. But again, I'm going to sort of split the difference here between the Apple TV that we have and an Apple-branded television set. I don't know why it's a set. There's only one, but here goes. I want somebody – we all know it won't be Samsung. I want somebody – who makes flat screen televisions in whatever flavors, to have a little spot on the back that's like a dock, but for the Apple TV. You know how you have the dock on your alarm clock or whatever with the 30 pins, you can stick your phone on it and be done. I want somebody to do that for the Apple TV and then allow you to control it with the TV remote. And it's just a TV that gives you an opportunity for like extra integration. You know, you can do everything through the television without having to switch to an input or do anything different. You can just hit an Apple TV button and go, bam, now you're watching Netflix or you're streaming music from the office or whatever.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up, because I'll take it one step further. And the thing I've been saying ever since these rumors started popping up was that I really think this is Apple's first opportunity to license one of its technologies to OEMs. I would like them just to build a, you know, a board, a platform that any TV manufacturer that wants to could integrate in, and they get all of that Apple TV functionality, app support, everything that goes along with an Apple TV sort of in one little package. Apple takes a cut, and really where Apple's going to make up the difference is in the content side of things. And then Apple can continue to focus on the content deals that they've been focusing on for a long time, and they'll have wider distribution. They can say, look, we've got X number of televisions out there with this technology in it, and it becomes
on
more
top
compelling
of all
on
the Apple TVs
on top of, and still sell the set, still sell the little box for people who want to plug it into a manufacturer maybe doesn't support it, but to me that seems the way they should be going. I don't want to see Apple getting in the TV business, and this is another argument that I've made. You know, it's great that Apple's gone into the consumer space, and we've got some consumer products with the iPhones and the iPads and stuff like that. At a certain point, I think they need to stop, because they're still, in the grand scheme of sizes of companies, Apple is still a relatively, they're a large company but not massive.
Yeah.
And I think they're already constrained too thin. And I think we've seen, especially this year, some areas where Apple's faltered on some things. And I attribute it to not being able to devote enough attention to any one thing. I think they're getting spread too thin, and they're not hiring to make up for the difference.
No.
And I always point to Sony from the 80s as being, you know, the company that this kind of happened to.
Yeah.
They started getting into all kinds of things and all over the map in terms of products. And
did it their own way.
Yeah.
I want to do this with, you know, I want to do this on my terms. So we're not going to make, we're going to make cameras, but they're not going to use SD cards like the rest of the world. They're not going to use CF like the other rest of the world.
Right.
We're going to use our own thing. We're going to build a game console, but it's going to be its own thing. We're going to build this, but it's going to do it our way. And
And they're still a, I mean, they're still a great company, but if you look at their products, you know, in the 80s, it was like Sony was the thing to buy when it came to consumer electronics, you know, TVs and stereos and things like that. Walkman. But when they started getting all over the place, it suddenly became, yeah, they still make good stuff, but not the best stuff.
Yeah. And but they're not in necessarily in the business of the TV. They're not necessarily in the business of the camera.
Right.
They're in the business of selling me stuff. And so it's decent stuff, but it's not woo stuff.
Yeah. So this is one area that Apple, I'm sure, can get into, and they may very well go that way. I think they could go a different direction and be just as successful. I don't want to see them OEMing, making their own brand of TV. Just let the TV manufacturers make those things.
I think that would be backwards. Cool piece. I think it's a step back for them, because if it weren't for Apple and if it weren't for iTunes, think where the music industry would be right now. And if it weren't for the video rental and the TV subscriptions, I mean, Apple has tried to do a lot to make it so that the TV isn't necessarily the only place you watch TV.
That's exactly it. The TV is not the thing that's broken.
Right.
It's the experience of TV. And I think that's what you were talking about when you were saying you had wished they had just, bought TiVo. It's the software piece. It's the, my television doesn't do the things that I want it to do, but not because it can't display a picture that's good or isn't thin enough or isn't, the right form factor, what have you. It's not necessarily the hardware. It's what it does in my interaction with it.
Right.
So Apple can solve that problem without having to, make the hardware too, I think.
And I think this is a prime example, like you were saying, license out a little circuit board that anybody can slap in a television. I mean, clearly that has worked for other people's software, because every Blu-ray player, a lot of televisions, every DVD player, now all of them come with Pandora and Netflix functionality right off the top. Sign in and go, basically. And and then they all have other stuff besides.
Yep.
And, other sort of online services that you can subscribe to.
And now TVs work with that.
Yeah. So why wouldn't you just go, hey, let's make an app, let's make a little circuit board. And now all these people who don't have Apple TV can have a TV. Because, I mean, to me, that would make way more sense than Apple getting into the hardware business. Would be Apple getting into, not necessarily getting into the television business, but getting into the, look at all the other people, because odds are good. Somebody who has a TV, who is going to buy one of these televisions, has an iPhone, so they have an Apple ID. Now you can get them renting movies from you on the TV.
Yeah.
Like, to look at that revenue stream, like you were talking about before, cash flow-driven decision-making, like, that to me is a slam dunk. If you're Apple, make this thing, have it, sell it on your terms. And if nobody wants one, that's fine. But the people who do, that's going to be a TV,
So to bring it
Panasonic
back.
Panasonic makes them, but other people don't, and now suddenly Panasonic sales are through the roof. Well, that's all you really needed to know, you know?
Well, and so bringing it back full circle to where we kind of started this thing off, the dilemma there then becomes lawyers and lobbies and lawsuits, because the cable companies are going to hate this kind of idea.
Yeah, but I kind of hope they do, because,
right, and they're going to try to do everything to stop that, because they do not want you getting your rentals from Apple. They want it through their on-demand service, right?
Right. But see, here's the thing. And I know, like I told you before, whatever the rule is, I'm the exception. I'm convinced it's going to be on my tombstone. Here lies Kelly, the exception to the rule. I never was an on-demand person. I never rented movies through my cable. I never watched any of the pay-per-view stuff. Like, I've never, ever, ever done any of that in my life, ever.
Me neither.
So if I could pay – now, however, if I could pay $5 or $10 a month extra and I could access those same shows, particularly what I'd like to do is pay it to TiVo, since I have two TiVo boxes in my house now. But we had to upgrade because one of them only does standard def. So we had to buy the TiVo HD.
Sure.
And if I could get for $5 or $10 a month, if they could make it so that I could watch that while I'm on the elliptical in the garage, which is one of the few rooms in my house without a television. But if I could take my iPad out there and I could be watching TV while I'm out there, I would watch the commercials too. If I could just watch, say, Oh, I might as well just come out of that closet. If I could watch Days of Our Lives while I'm out there on the elliptical for an hour in the afternoon, I would be pleased to bits to do that. And I would pay more for that. But instead, by locking everything down and tying everything to an actual TV set, and in this case, one single TV set, I can't even watch the stuff on my TiVo in the living room. I can't even watch it in the bedroom.
Right.
So if I'm sick, I have to determine, do I lay in here and watch what I can watch in the bedroom, or do I upgrade to the couch so I can watch TiVo? And if they would make it so that I could do that, like, I'm not trying to scam anybody out of anything, but since they're trying so hard to make it that way, they're making it so that I'm not watching television as much at all.
Yeah. Well, and so John Martellaro over at Mac Observer put out a piece about some of his thoughts on this Apple TV thing. And in there, one thing he does point out, if Apple does do a TV, be it their own TV or this OEM thing, you know, it's going to have that Apple TV processor and little board in there, or, you know, components. Well, you get AirPlay, and you could do reverse AirPlay at that point. So you could AirPlay from your TV to your iPad. Problem solved.
That pleases me. Because you know what I do? I don't watch anything. I have Comcast. And I'm not watching Comcast programming when I'm in the garage on the elliptical. I'm watching Netflix on the elliptical.
Right.
Let's be honest. I'm watching TV shows from the BBC.
Absolutely, because they're awesome.
They're awesome. Doctor Who, hello, Sherlock, Monty Python, like... I'll stand out there and walk for a while, and it's a nice way to pass the time because it's hard to read on the elliptical.
Right.
So even with an iPad. So those are some, that's, you know, to me, I feel like this is another one of those opportunities where you have a chance to get more money from people like me, but by being so paranoid because of stuff that you've heard, then you're making it so you're getting less money from me than you would have before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, it's going to be an interesting year. I'm looking forward to,
absolutely,
2012. So do you have time? We were going to go through some of Apple's picks and maybe some of our picks for 2011 apps. Let's just do the apps because we're kind of running long on time. But Apple came out, as they do at the end of every year, with their, what they call it, their 2011 Rewind.
Uh-huh.
And it's on iTunes, and if you go to the App Store, I think you can see that now.
It's one of the big rotating banners.
Yeah,
so if, like, you don't see it, wait a few seconds, and it'll flip through.
And they've done it for both iOS apps and Mac apps. Let's just do, we'll do the iOS apps, and then maybe some of our picks, and we'll kind of say if we agree with Apple's picks. So iPhone, and I guess they separated iPhone and iPad apps.
They did.
So let's, iPhone app of the year, Instagram. Are you an Instagram user?
I pink puffy heart Instagram.
Me too.
And you know, here's the thing is that everybody goes, oh, it's just because of filters, you know, and like Instagram filters are the auto tune of photography. And so much of the stuff that I post is no filter at all. It's just a fast, easy way for me to put something out there for people to see. And there's some overlap between the people that I follow and follow me on Instagram and follow me on like Twitter or Facebook or what have you. But not a whole lot. And so I really enjoy Instagram because it's just another means of discovery. And I really like seeing what other people are doing with their cameras.
Yeah. It's cool because you can just share those quick shots and it's kind of one step. You know, the one that I like better and I got hooked on was Hipstamatic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just as far as like sharing that stuff out. Yeah, I can do it. But, you know, having it kind of all in one app and still having those cool effects, you know, with Hipstamatic, it's got the in-app purchase and you can buy additional effects and things like that. And I bought them all. I think it's still a good value. But Instagram at free, I think, is just that's
well, and I really like, I really like Hipstamatic, but I like Hipstamatic when I want to play with a picture. I took this picture. What all could I do with it? Could I do something to take this? You know, I think it's a good photo, but I feel like it needs some help. So let me run a few filters against it and see if I can get the red to pop out or, you know, something.
Well,
So that's what I use Hipstamatic for, is can I take this picture and somehow improve it? And then Instagram I use for, I want to show this to people. So I was watching the Pee Wee Herman Christmas special the other night. And it's adorable. It's the Pee Wee's Playhouse Christmas special. If you can't rent it, it's on DVD to own really cheaply, and you should totally get it because it's just so lovely. And So I was I was taking pictures and like sharing them, and Instagram hooks up to everything. I think that's awesome. And so it was a really easy way for me to share, like, here's Oprah Winfrey back when she still had to use her last name on the Pee Wee Herman Christmas special. And, you know, here's Charo and here's Cher. And
oh my gosh.
Like, it was, I mean, yeah, they were all on the Christmas. It was great. Anyway, like, I really like the quick and the immediacy of Instagram. Like, yeah. I've shot parades. I took a bunch of pictures at Disneyland. I have these two Lego guys that travel with me and I take pictures of them. And they are like, it's a complete blast, and randomly other people have found me and I've randomly found other people, and seeing what people are doing. Part of the reason I like that it's still currently, I know an Android version is coming, but right now it's basically limited to the iPhone, is that it's really hard to take a photo that you didn't shoot with your phone and share it through Instagram. Because you have to sync it to your phone first, and then you have to go choose it out and share it. So I really like seeing what people are actually doing with their iPhone cameras.
Yep.
And to me, that's the part that's the most impressive.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably the app of the year.
It's interesting that you mentioned the editing side, you know, kind of playing with photos more with the Hipstamatic, because on the iPad side, the app of the year, it's also interesting that I didn't realize this, you know, this didn't occur to me before that both these apps are photo apps. Snapseed is the iPad app.
Yeah,
which
that's a nice app.
I'm in love with. I used to work for Nix Software, so I know the team and the people that actually built this app.
Yeah.
And it's a photo editing app, and I think it's the best one on the iPad. So very often what I do, I don't do the Hipstamatic thing. I'll shoot stuff with my phone and then use the camera connection kit to suck it into the iPad and then play with it in Snapseed over there.
Cool. Very nice.
Yeah. Because you can do the selective editing, you can do all kinds of color correction, you can throw on frames, you can do like just amazing, amazing stuff with that app. And I think it's like $5, and
well worth it if you don't
have it. So yeah. I was happy to see them win that.
I'm going
to
talk for a second about price, because this is something that always sort of upsets me, is people going $5, but you know. Like, think about it for a minute. If you're a person who drinks what I call the foofy coffee, you know, you get the Frappuccino with the whipped cream and the this and the that and the thing and the stuff, that's $5 there. So put it in, you know, I always call them Starbucks units. Put it in units of Starbucks. Like, how many of the thing that you normally order at Starbucks are you really talking about for a piece of software? And if you think about it that way for a minute, sometimes it's not so bad.
Well,
I'll tell you one of my personal picks for the end of the year,
because
it's for the end of the year, is the Charlie Brown Christmas app.
Oh, you know, I haven't bought that yet.
Perfect on the iPad. Okay, go buy it now. I'll talk while you go hit install.
I've been meaning
seriously,
to.
It's that good. It's like $6.99. It is fantastic. I don't care if you're a grown up or a kid, or you're a grown up who knows a kid, has a kid. If you're a kid with an iPad, who knows a grown-up? Whoever you are, this is the funnest app that I've played with in a long time. When you first launch the app, for people who are of a certain vintage, you remember watching this on television every year growing up. And you will also remember this. This is why I say if you are of a particular vintage. When you launch the app, it shows you the cover of the book, A Charlie Brown Christmas, and there's a record player. And the record player is playing the theme from the Charlie Brown Christmas special, Christmas Time Is Here. And it's playing it on a record player. And the record is spinning around, and you can hear the frying bacon of listening to a record. And it is so cool. And then you open the book, and there's a little Christmas tree on the first page, and you can decorate the Christmas tree. And, you know, the first page of the actual story is them skating. And the voice that narrates the book is the guy that played Charlie Brown as a kid. And so he's grown up, and he narrates the book. And when he reads it, and then you can tap on the words, and he will say the individual word, and it's highlighted. So for kids who are learning to read, a plus. And then the kids are skating on the pond, and as you tap on each kid, they do a little skate back and forth. And every single page is something awesome like this. And there's something new to discover on every single page. I'm still only like halfway through it, and I'm having a complete blast. And I entertained kids with it. My cousins all have loads of kids, and we all got together for Thanksgiving. So I managed to fascinate a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 6-year-old with the Charlie Brown Christmas app because they all wanted to touch stuff. What does this do? How does that work? And they were finding stuff I hadn't even seen. And it was great. And we had such a good time. And, you know, it's got the nostalgia factor for the adults. It's got the interactivity for the kids. And it is so the best thing. And it's $7. And you're not going to get anywhere near that much joy out of going and buying the paperback of a Charlie Brown Christmas, which is probably like 10 bucks.
Right.
It is beautiful.
I'll do a holiday pick kind of like that too. That's kind of frivolous. And I picked this up because I mentioned I'm in this iOS development group and I saw this on some blogs somewhere and I was very curious about just the tech and the technology. And I'm a toy person. I love little kitschy toys and stuff like that. I always have. Have you seen the App Mates? Maybe you even tried it out for the Disney App Mates, the little cars, and you can get them in the Apple Store now. They come in a 2-pack or 1-pack, and you know it's a little physical plastic car, and they're cars like from Pixar, you know, the movie Cars, and I think they're based on Cars 2, actually.
Like Mater and somebody, one of the sets.
The characters from Cars 2. And but I was more curious how they work, because the way it works is there's a free app that you download from the App Store, and then you get this little physical car, and it's got little conductive touch points on the bottom of the car, and you launch the app, and then you set the car on the screen, and you kind of hold it with two fingers in the middle of the screen, and then the scene, the road, you drive around Radiator Springs, which is the place from the film, and the way you drive around is you turn the car, you know, like you would on the carpet when you were a kid, you know, you drive around the carpet, except here you drive it on your iPad, and the scene actually kind of rolls by, and so it's like you're driving around the town, and you control it all with the car. But what put me over the top with it, so it's fun, it's got some games, and you're supposed to go around, and you collect hubcaps, and then you can buy upgrades for your car.
Okay.
And that's where it gets really interesting, because one, the system can recognize the car by the little pads, the touch points, the placement of them, and of course, I get into my iOS developer group, and they're immediately going, hey, can you like game this? Like, if you put three fingers down in the right spot, could you get it? Because you unlock the car by, you know, buying the physical car and putting it on the thing, and it goes into your collection. And we found out you actually can. You can kind of game it if you can figure out the orientation of the three little touch points. So it's not that sophisticated, but that's what I love about it, because the other thing, the cars have. You can get, like, one of your upgrades is you can get different color headlights. So you have, like, regular headlights, and then you can change from day to night. When you go at night, you can see the color of the headlight projects out of the front of your little physical car. But not only that, the cars themselves have little plastic headlights in them. And I noticed when I started playing with it, hey, these headlights are lighting up, but there's no battery in the little physical car. So if you flip it upside down and you look, they just have clear plastic channels that go up from the bottom of the car to where the headlights are on the front of the physical thing.
So it's just putting a light on
it's
the screen.
It's like a fiber optic.
Spot?
Yeah, it like pulls. And so when you're playing the game, if you kind of look under the car, what you'll see is they just put a colored block in the right place. So if you have purple headlights, they just
that
put
so
two little
cool.
purple blocks and suddenly the – yeah, so – I'm picking this because the tech behind it is cool. The gameplay is fine.
Well, and
it's
the potential.
Fun.
Yeah, but the potential for where that could go is very, very cool.
Well, and when you buy upgrades, you can get, you know, like a tow hook, or you can get like missile launchers. And when you get the missile launchers and you activate them, they roll out from the sides of the car. And so they're displayed on the screen.
Yeah.
But they kind of look like they're sitting,
you know,
coming out of your physical car. So
I was curious about the Crayola stylus majigger.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I haven't played with it yet. I was thinking of getting my niece one for Christmas because my sister got an iPad. And I was thinking maybe that would be a cool thing for her because it kind of looks like she could color without markers, which, you know, for a 4-year-old is a good thing.
Yeah. So, real quick on the App Mates thing. So the cars, I think it's one car for $13 and you can get a 2-pack of the cars for $20. Mm-hmm. The app itself is free. And if you do get the app and you don't have the physical cars, they do have a mode called, they call it paper car. They give you kind of a little cutout on the screen. So you can, if you want to get a feel for the gameplay and you don't want to buy the cars yet, you can download the app and kind of try it out. So they give you a trial, which was smart too. I thought that was very smart on the part of the developers that,
definitely.
You know, because so often something will get negative reviews because it'll be like, oh, you have to have the physical cars. It's not really free. Well, this one really is free. You do get to play the full game. It's not locked or anything, but it becomes more fun, I think, with the little toys.
One of the other apps that caught my eye that I just want to give a pitch to is under books on the iPhone side. I've only played it on the iPad. But one of the book picks from Apple is Bartleby's Book of Buttons. And if you haven't played with this, go get it. It's $3. I believe it's universal, but I've just only ever played with it on the iPad. And there's little puzzles that you have to solve to get to the next page of the story to see what's happening. And it's all about this guy, Bartleby, and he has a book, and it's full of buttons. And what he does with them, and there's little adventures. There's two volumes of it now, and it's very exciting. And one of the nicest moments of it for me was actually giving it to a kid, my niece who's 4. We played with it, and she said, "This is really fun. I like this kind of game." And so we would listen to the story, and then you had to figure out how to unlock the puzzle on that page before you could get to the next page. And she had such a blast with it. It was a time. And the music's really cute and the voices are good. And, you know, there's some stuff that's kind of silly. And so those are great. So that's one that they have on there that I totally recommend. I also recommend any of the Sesame Street titles. There is a monster at the end of this book, now comes in an iPad flavor, which cool. pleases me greatly. There's another monster at the end of this book, which is Grover and Elmo, which I have not yet played with, but I'm sure is awesome. Because, you know, the first one was fantastic. And that was a book I grew up reading, so it was really fun for me to get to read that with my niece. And there's a Sesame Street one where Elmo helps teach you the alphabet. And if you're somebody who has a kid that's learning letters and, you know, recognizing them and maybe writing them a little, that's a really good app. And I liked it because it's free. You can download it. And it's free, but the free only gives you like A, B, and C. So at least you can try it out, and then you can upgrade to the full version later. But if you just want to get a feel for it, I think it's Elmo's ABCs or something like that.
Very cool.
iPhone Game of the Year, they picked Tiny Tower.
Yeah. I'm not a huge gamer. Tiny Wings got a runner-up, and I loved Tiny Wings.
I think Tiny Wings is a lot of fun, and I think if Tiny Tower had been released earlier in the year, maybe it would have been the runner-up, and Tiny Wings would be the top pick.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I don't like about Tiny Tower is the same kind of problem I have with a lot of these games where, you know, they're sort of like Farmville style. You plant stuff, and you come back later and harvest,
yeah.
you know, time-based things. The thing about Tiny Tower, which was kind of where I lost my taste for it, was there comes a point where basically it's kind of a grind unless you buy upgrades.
Yeah. Yep.
Tiny Tower involves an elevator, and there's a point where basically it's not going to be any fun for you to continue unless you buy upgrades in order to get the elevator. And I mean buy with money. I don't mean like you unlock stuff.
Yeah. The same thing happened with, I was a huge fan of Wii Farm and Wii Rule, and
yeah.
they kept changing the game dynamics until it got to that point, and that's when I stopped
yeah.
playing.
When Wii Rule got questy, I was like, ooh, I'm back into it again. Like I was kind of casually playing every so often, and then I was back to every day with the questing, and then it was basically you have to buy stuff with money in order to get where you're going.
Yep.
And I'm not jazzed about that. It's part of what I was having this conversation with Daniel Jalkut the other night about Words with Friends, because Zynga's doing the same thing with those. You can buy an advantage over someone else for like a dollar. So, and the reason that kind of bugs me with Words with Friends is because it's Words with Friends.
Right.
You know, yep. so I can be playing with you, Adam, and, you know, we're playing, and then secretly on the side, I go, ooh, I want an advantage. And if I give them a dollar, then I get better tiles somehow, and all you get is Q, E, 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 X, V. And then, you know, I get S, T, R, A, L, E, and I can build anything, and you're screwed. And I don't think that's okay.
Yeah. It ruins the game dynamic. So I think this comes back to what you were mentioning earlier about, you know, price too. Sometimes there's advantages of just buying a really good app and supporting a developer that's uh-huh. their revenue stream. It's not some other secondary freemium revenue stream. I just saw somebody had written an article about this too recently that, you know, the freemium thing is interesting and works to a point, but at a certain point, you know, you might as well just pay $10 for a really good game
yeah.
on the iPad and let the developer make their money that way and bring out the right. next title that's going to be great again. So
yeah. And the thing that I like particularly about Charlie Brown is that so far I still feel like I've like page two, I felt like I'd gotten my money's worth. And like I said, it's like $6 or $7.
Well, and I was trying to remind people to put this in perspective. You know, like an app like Snapseed, Mm-hmm. Nix Software, all their other products prior to this, cheapest product that I think they sold was around $200. They do high-end Photoshop plugins for photographers. And mm-hmm. a lot of the core technologies are still in this Snapseed product, and you're getting them for $5. So it's yeah. like, it's a bargain.
Yeah,
a bargain
absolutely.
At that price. So,
and
yep, sorry.
Go ahead. I just love, maybe this is, again, one of the things that comes with the position I'm in as a tech blogger, as an Apple person, as somebody who's active in the tech scene here in Portland, where we have a lot of developers. Mm-hmm. Small Society is here. Night and Day Studios is here. The guy that built Webstagram, I think it is, lives here. I know tons of people who build stuff for iOS, tons and tons and tons of people. Small Society built the Starbucks app.
Oh,
and the
awesome.
Zipcar app,
mm-hmm.
they're people who build stuff you've heard of. And so I know a lot of those people. And so, and I know them, I know what they're like. We hang out, buy somebody a beer once in a while. And so I'll evaluate it, but I'll usually feel good about kicking that $5 or, $6 minus 30%.
Right.
to somebody. Like, I feel like there's somebody somewhere. And and the second piece of that is we hear from people all the time over at Tua when we write something up. Have you seen this app? This app is amazing. It's so great. It does the most wonderful thing. If I had written a review of, not that it needed the help, but say I'd written a review of the Charlie Brown Christmas app and it was just some indie developer who'd put it together, we get the nicest emails from people all the time after we feature their app, because it gets them a lot of traffic and it makes them a lot of money. And I'm somebody who uses a lot of apps. I do buy my share. I am not a developer, so I feel like that's always something I can give back to the community, because
yep.
I'm not writing awesome code for people, but all I can do is tell other people, this is what you should totally have. Like, the game I'm crushing on right now is Tap Tap Muppets, which is US only. But I am a huge Muppet nerd. I have been for basically my entire life. And so getting to play basically Rock Band on my phone, because that's what the Tap Tap games are very much like.
Right.
Getting to play that with Muppet songs is awesome. And animals drumming in the back as the dots come down.
Oh, I'm getting
and
this right now.
It's free.
We just bought Amazon. They had it, and we had it in our cart. I don't know if you knew this. They had a pack where it was the first three seasons, or all the seasons, I guess, of, or there's been five seasons. First three
seasons
of the Muppet
exists.
Show.
Three are on DVD.
Yes. So those three DVDs,
uh-huh.
plus the Muppet movie, plus mm-hmm. Muppet Treasure Island.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which I recommend if you've not seen it, I enjoy it.
$3, I think is what it was.
Man, see, I have them all already, because I bought the first edition of all of the Muppet Show releases,
yeah.
so my cases are fuzzy.
Yeah, but we
case.
Had to get, yeah, we had to get yeah. that on black. That's very cool. But we had to get that on a Black Friday thing. They had it.
Yeah.
We had it in our cart. We didn't pull the trigger on buying it. And suddenly we go back one day and it was $150.
Yep.
And then just before Black Friday, they came out and said, we're going to do it. It's going to be really limited. So
yeah.
we were like on there that morning and we're like, get it. So
yes.
yeah, we've been
totally
going through all the old Muppet shows.
Yeah.
So I'm with you on the Muppet thing. So
I really enjoy Muppet Treasure Island, probably more than I should, but I love it because Tim Curry has a complete blast in it, and you can just tell
yeah.
he's having a good time. And those are always, for me, the fun movies to watch when people are having fun. And there's a bit where he gets out of the boat and he goes, make it good, boys. This is my only production number. And that makes me laugh every time.
It's great.
So yeah, I could sit here and Muppet with you all day long. But,
yeah, probably could continue this show all day long. So that
yeah.
says to me,
every
time this happens on this means that I need to get you back. So we
Yay!
Will have you back some other time, and we'll talk about other great Mac Apple stuff. But until
awesome.
Then, people should go check you out over at the Unofficial Apple Web Blog. Read your stuff. Mm-hmm. I love it. Every time you post something, it's like, it's funny because oftentimes I'll read through something and then look at who wrote it. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's one of Kelly's. I knew because I enjoyed that article. So you can find you there and on the Talkcast and over on Angry Mac Bastards and mm-hmm. International Mac Podcast. And then also at Verso on Twitter. And they should follow you too, because you tweet some pretty funny stuff.
Yay. Well, thank you.
And next time I'm in Portland, I'm coming and we're going to McMenamin's and I'm getting a Captain Neon Burger and a Terminator Stout. So
awesome.
Cause I miss
that
most
of
all
over the place.
Well, that's probably what I miss most about Portland at this point. That and the theater pubs.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of people who miss just eating here. So,
yes,
you know,
in general, I miss food's good. I don't miss the rain even more so just the gray weather. But
yeah, there's a lot of gray.
We won't go there.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun. And yeah, the theater pub is also another thing that seems to be unique. I explain that to people and they just don't seem to understand. So you can go to a movie and drink beer
and eat burgers and
it's like $4.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Yeah. Yeah. So that's always fun. And thanks so much for having me on. I had such a good time.
Thanks for coming on. So Kelly Gaumont, we will talk to you hopefully real soon.
Yay. Thanks.
So there you go. That's Kelly. And I hope you had a good time listening to that. I know I had a good time just hanging out with her for a little bit and chatting about Apple Mac stuff. That's what this community is all about, right? Just having these great conversations and learning some things along the way. So I hope you learned some things. I know I did, and I found out about some great apps. I downloaded immediately the Muppet app and the Charlie Brown Christmas app that she recommended, and they're both absolutely fabulous. So I can vouch for those now. And that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of our show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can find more information and details and get free trials over at circusponies.com. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze, check out their stuff, get more information, details, as well as trials over at pharonix.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, a whole bunch of great products that you really should check out. Get more information, details, as well as trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you know, when you get those new electronics, it's time to get rid of the old stuff. And Gazelle is a great way to do that and get some cash back. So you can check it out at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support of the show. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. Love getting your questions. Anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, if you have a tech question, send that along. MacCast@gmail.com is the email address, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or if you prefer Skype, you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is TheMacCast. And be sure to check out MacCast.com. There you'll find show notes with links to everything I talked about in this and any other episode of the MacCast. I also post some things there occasionally. I just posted a quick tip on how to get some functionality back in iPhoto, a video tip. Also have the YouTube channel if you want to check that out, or Vimeo for the videos. And be sure to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And those communities, you know, there's great places to follow me between shows. I do just post cool things that I find as I'm doing research for this show. So stuff that you might normally get, cool videos, cool applications, products, and things like that that I find, I try and put up on the feed, especially over on Facebook. I'm trying to do more of that. So check that out. And that's going to do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.